We who live in the United States of America often believe we are invincible, though a lot of that invincibility has been knocked out of us since 9/11. But we also now begin to face an uncertain future, many of us. We may be the lone superpower in the world at this moment, but beyond our military prowess, which really doesn't help us all that much in terms of places like France or the Middle East for that matter, we are falling behind many other nations, including our own allies, in terms of things like higher education, secondary education, infant mortality rates, healthcare costs, and much, much more than this. And watching the Republicans debate, you can feel the angst rising up in the room and in the nation. So maybe we are in a position to understand the message that Hosea had to deliver to the Northern Kingdom. I have to confess that I like Hosea, though there's not much about his message beyond these verses that we heard here in chapter 11 that's to like. It's a book that's really about doom and gloom. Hosea marries a prostitute who spends his days worrying about a woman who refuses to abandon her trade. And though she has children with Hosea, we suppose, though it could be the mailman, they are stuck with names like Not Pitied and Not My People. Hello, this is my daughter, Not To Be Pitied, and Not My People. They will grow up without much that would seem to be in line with what we would call parental care or responsibility. The parents, Hosea and Gomer, like God in the book of Hosea, seem to have a lot to say, but do not do a lot in terms of raising their children. From this agonizing family situation, Hosea teaches us what God feels about Israel, about his children, which is what Hosea feels about his wife Gomer, namely that he has been rejected, he's been abandoned, and he's been humiliated. To quote Bob Dylan, we have a situation that is tangled up in blue. Like any other unpleasant experience, like hiking the Appalachian Trail or preparing for a colonoscopy. We may not want to go through the process of it, but we are the better for having the procedure nonetheless. Most of us prefer, you see, a loving God to an angry one. Most of us prefer to see God as a benevolent father figure at best. And we know that God has those images in the scriptures, but there are also these images of God as an angry parent who wants to do unto his kids as his kids have been doing unto him. We just wish that they weren't this complicated. They complicate our theology, they complicate our image of God. We like a loving and gentle God, but not so much a judgmental God. Yet with God, it seems you cannot have one without the other. Think not that I have come to bring peace, but a sword, Jesus reminds us. Not surprising is the fact that there is very little good news, if any, in this book, even though it sounds a little rosy at the end of chapter 11, verse 9 and 10. This book doesn't end on a happy note at all. Before too long, the nation of Israel will cease to exist. In 722 BCE, there will be complete and utter destruction of the nation at the hands of the Assyrians, though God promises that they'll return, that they'll be forgiven. That doesn't take place. The Assyrians will be followed by the Babylonians, will be followed by the Persians, will be followed by the Macedonians, will be followed by the Romans, and on and on and on. And not until 1948 will there ever again be a nation called Israel. In our text, Hosea 11, chapter 11, the voice of a scorned husband turns to that of an unfaithful, from a scorned husband talking about an unfaithful wife to that of a voice of a parent speaking about an unfaithful child. That the parent still seems to love, at least verbally, but seems unwilling to help in any real sense of the word, help. And what we are left with is an audible monologue that God seems to have with himself out loud and allows us to listen in on, as if to say, this, by the way, could be you. And in this divine monologue, God oscillates between longing for the good old days when children knew their place in the family hierarchy, seen but not heard, a place under their parents' guidance and authority, but then suddenly we find that the children are out of control with little, if any, parental guidance, almost like an addict caught in a death spiral that God seems unwilling or unable to stop. And what follows is utter death and destruction as the only viable option as the children play out a tragedy that only death, it seems, can cure. Yet there are loving parental acts by God mentioned here on full display in verses 5 through 7. I loved, I called, I taught, I took them up, I healed, I led, I bent down, and I fed. All wonderful verbs. But even with these very same verses, God is nowhere to be seen. Not in terms of his parenting, anyway. He's off somewhere in the heavens, talking to himself, as if all sense of parenting has gone now from God. And he's left the children in charge of the kingdom. The sword now becomes the primary actor in the drama that unfolds in Hosea, the agent of judgment in these verses, with Israel continuing to spiral out of control. And then suddenly in verses 8 through 9, akin to a bipolar mood swing, God is once again the center of attention, but here the focus is not on what God is doing or has done for Israel, but how God feels about the situation that Israel is in. God is mortified at what's happening to Israel. God is ashamed as to what is happening to Israel, yet God refuses to get involved, and God allows the tragedy to continue. And unlike Judah, the southern tribe in Jerusalem, Israel will get no mercy from God. There will be no return from exile for Israel. They will eventually become the Samaritans, the often mentioned and often hated brothers and sisters of the southern tribe of Judah, as we've heard in the New Testament. And finally, in verses 10 and 11, there is another divine mood swing back with the unkept promise that after Israel has been subjected to extreme violence by Assyria, she will be allowed to crawl back to God. In verse 11, it says, like a trembling little bird. Hosea 11 thus sounds a lot like an abusive parent to me, to be honest, who takes no responsibility for any harm done during this episode of violent discipline. It reminds me of the flood narrative in Genesis, after which God sends a rainbow as if to say, oh, I'm sorry, honey. I promise I'll never go off on you like that again. And no matter how much we might want to be sympathetic to God, how much we might want to defend God's honor, so to speak, and make excuses for God's lack of intervention, there is no way that we can minimize the suffering or the destruction that takes place. The Assyrians literally obliterate the northern kingdom. They take their people into exile. They force them to intermarry. Their religious traditions, their culture, their ways of being are all gone. All gone. And yet, these are his children, the chosen people. Wow. Now, when I was in seminary, we were repeatedly challenged to answer this question in preaching class. So what's the good news, Steve, of the text? Got to leave the people with some good news. And obviously, I don't think that's an answer that I can easily give you in this week's text. I don't think there's a lot of good news here. It is true that when compared to the other deities in the region, if we were to compare God to the God of the Assyrians, Baal, he is far more humane, our God, emotionally mature, as well as less arbitrary and less capricious than any of his competitors, because he does not ask for human or desire human sacrifice. They all do. But that's in comparison. That's like comparing us to somebody who beats his wife and his kids and does so and thinks he's doing a good job as a parent, and saying, but after all, he didn't kill them. Most of us may not see this text or this book offering anything in the way of good news, to be really honest. Sometimes good news is hard to find, just like it is right now in France and in the rest of the world. It seems as if the world is spiraling out of control. It seems as if the rumors of wars and earthquakes and so forth are coming true, just as Mark's gospel told us. But we do not see signs so much of the Messiah. We do not see signs of God's intervention so much today, do we? But rather along the lines of prepping for a colonoscopy, something that we must do from time to time, something we may need but not like. Sometimes for us, as Bob Dylan likes to say in our thought for the day, she was married when we first met, soon to be divorced. I helped her out of a jam, I guess, but I used a little too much force. I heard her say, "We'll meet again someday on the avenue, tangled up in blue." Sometimes that's what we are, tangled up in blue. Amen.